We are back. We are privileged to have on this segment of the program Roger S. Peterson, a business writer, marketing consultant, and Western historian from Loomis. Welcome to the show, Roger.
Hello. How you doing?
You are an expert on much of the aspects of the Old West, and particularly the lore that surrounds a legendary Western gunman, Wyatt Earp.
Yes. He would not like being called a gunman, but...
A lawman, I guess you'd say.
He wouldn't even like that. He only spent 6 of his 80 years with a badge on, and he never wanted to talk about it.
Now, when I was a kid, and we're about the same age, when Wyatt Earp was a big thing. I mean, there was a TV program featuring Hugh O'Brien, which I guess ran for, what, about 6 or 7 years?
From 1955 to 61.
Okay, and I remember watching that show when I was in kindergarten, I guess, and Bat Masterson, a bunch of other Westerns were big.
In the 50s, they were. There are approximately 7 or 8 movies that have been made about Wyatt Earp, and upwards of 20 books.
I guess there was the one in the 50s was a really big one with Burt Lancaster and with Kirk Douglas.
Terrible.
And more recently, we've had, I guess, back-to-back, Tombstone with Kurt Russell and Val Kilmer, and I guess Kevin Costner got involved.
Yes, they did. And they both came out the same year, and they tried to negotiate with each other because they didn't want to divide the pie too much, but they decided to go ahead, both of them.
Tombstone, and I guess most of the Earp legend, what makes him such a solid, singular figure in the Old West, is this famous gunfight at the OK Corral. Maybe we should start with that.
Well, if you want to be a really in Earp historian, you never refer to it as the gunfight at the OK Corral.
Okay.
Because it never really occurred inside the OK Corral. It happened primarily in Fremont Street, off of the vacant lot that was in the back entrance to the OK Corral. So historians call it the street fight, and it was referred to as the street fight up until 1931. In 1931, Stuart Lake, a magazine writer, managed to convince Wyatt Earp that Stuart Lake should do his biography. And when Lake put together the biography, it came to what should we call the street fight? And basically, we assume that Lake concluded that I can't very well call this the gunfight in Fremont Street near the vacant lot to the entrance to the back end of the OK Corral. Let's just call it the gunfight at the OK Corral, and history was made from there on in.
The marketing decision.
Yes.
A good one, it sounds like.
Yes.
Now, it's quite clear in talking to you before the program, Roger, you genuinely admire Mr. Earp.
Yes, he's an interesting and an extremely complex man, but any discussion of Wyatt Earp has to recognize the two realities. One was the actual person, and number two is the person he was made into by mass communications, mass media, the movies, and so on. And during the 1920s, which was his last decade, he became extremely frustrated with what magazine writers were saying about him. And he was an extremely private person, a very quiet person, didn't talk much, kept his friends and his family close to him. And he did not want to talk about his days in the Old West. He primarily considered himself a businessman. In the directories in San Francisco and other cities, he listed himself as a businessman. Sometimes he listed himself as a horseman or a capitalist, but he never listed himself as a law enforcement officer. Those were days that he didn't want to talk about. I interviewed his third wife's niece, Alice Greenberg, in San Francisco in 1982. She knew Wyatt Earp for 20 years, saw him a week before he died, and knew his wife, Josephine, his third wife, Josephine, for 40 years. And she said that, you know, he was just my uncle. We didn't think anything of it in the 1920s. We would go down and visit him at his home in Los Angeles. And sometimes us kids would gather around him and say, hey, Uncle Wyatt, can you tell us about the old days in the old Wild and Woolly West? And he would simply put up his hands and say, I'm sorry, there are more pleasant things that we can talk about.
Right.
And every reference we've ever had of someone who knew him is the common assertion that he didn't want to talk about it. It wasn't anything that he wanted to visit or review with people, and he very much resented the attention he was getting.
So he's quite the opposite of a figure like Buffalo Bill Cody, who was sort of a shameless self-promoter.
Right, exactly.
In preparation for this discussion with you, because I don't know that much about this subject, I watched Tombstone last night, and I thought, you know, I didn't think it was a very good movie myself. I guess it's historically gets a lot of points for getting it correctly.
Up to a point, yes.
But this whole Western legend of the gunman and doing justice and shooting people down, it was certainly the kind of approach to Western lore that the NRA would wholeheartedly approve of, complete with Charlton Heston as a subsidiary role in the movie.
Right.
I guess a lot of what this Western lore, what we regard as this the gunfights in the street, comes from these dime novels being produced in the late 19th century.
Correct. And Wyatt Earp was never the subject of a dime novel, but there was this glorification of
people. A lot of others were.
Yeah, Wild Bill Hickok and Buffalo Bill and a few other people. And, you know, Wild Bill Hickok was a completely insignificant person. He was just a kind of a psychopathic gambler.
Mm-hmm.
And Buffalo Bill became a major entertainer right through to his death. Wyatt Earp was in a different category for a lot of different reasons. For one, he lasted longer than anybody. He died in 1929.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, a lot of events associated with his life became the fodder for the American Western.
Uh-huh.
The notion of the lone, dedicated peace officer facing down the adversaries in the middle of a street was basically can be attributed to events that occurred in the very short 6 years that Wyatt Earp served with a badge.
All right, well, let's get to the subject. I think the movie Tombstone and so much of the lore of Earp surrounds that famous gunfight that took place on Fremont Street, the street fight. In the movie, you have the situation where Virgil, Morgan, Wyatt Earp, and Doc Holliday going out to fight these Clantons, McLaurys, and all these guys. They're portrayed as very, very bad guys in the movie. I mean, were they?
The Clantons and McLaurys were part of one of two very large groups of cattle fencers or rustlers, whatever term you want to use, that were causing so much problems in Arizona that it was reaching all the way to Washington, D.C. At one point, President Chester Arthur was threatening martial law. That was in 1882 after mm-hmm. the gunfight. But these guys were causing a lot of difficulties, especially because they were rustling cattle over the border in Mexico, and the Mexican mm-hmm. government did not appreciate that.
Uh-huh.
The Mexican government was complaining to the government of the United States about what was going on in their new territory of Arizona. The territorial government could not do anything about the rustlers, and it came to a head in March of 1881 when the rustlers really stepped over the line and held up a stage. And they killed a popular crewman on that stage.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, what may have been tolerated by certain people, for example, the meat markets in Tombstone and other towns, they got cheap meat from these guys.
So they were okay with it up to that point.
Yeah, they were okay up to a point. But when they start shooting people, all of a sudden it became a very difficult situation where the territorial government and the county government, the sheriff, couldn't do anything about it. And it turned out the sheriff of Cochise County was affiliated in some way with these crooks.
So they were probably giving him some payoffs? Or
yes.
So at this point in time, Tombstone, I guess, is a mining town and is, I guess, the biggest town in Arizona?
At the time, Tombstone was a very big city. It may have reached upwards of 14,000 people. The population figures differ a lot, I believe, because sometimes they didn't include the Chinese citizens uh-huh. in the tally. But at one point, it could have been 14,000 people, and it was a silver mining town.
Uh-huh.
Filled with French restaurants, plush hotels, ice cream parlors, cold beer, lots of saloons, and it was a great city for entertainment.
Which is it's not a vision you have of the 1880s Southern Arizona.
No.
You told me before this, and we were talking about this, that they actually brought in lobster, frozen lobster?
Yeah, you could get lobster or clams, oysters.
That's incredible.
In Tombstone at the time. The menus are fantastic. We have some of the menus.
Wow.
And it was quite a town. There was a lot of entertainment. Eddie Foy once played there.
Huh.
And it was one of the major cities on the West Coast.
So in this city, you have a situation where they're trying to institute the old law and order with a lot of desperados and gunmen and ne'er-do-wells running about, gambling halls, prostitution, like in any kind of mining situation, any boom town. In the middle of this, you have, I guess, an ineffective sheriff. In the movie, they talk about these guys are marshals. Virgil becomes a marshal. The Herbs become marshals. How does a marshal differ from a sheriff in the Old West?
Well, a sheriff was a county official, and the task of the sheriff was was primarily tax collection. And Wyatt at one time wanted to run for sheriff because it was a very lucrative position in the Old West. But Virgil became chief of police of Tombstone. But at the same time, while he was chief of police of Tombstone, uh-huh, a city position, he was also a deputy U.S. marshal. And he would deputize his brothers as city marshals, too. It's important to note that the term marshal could mean one of two things in the Old West. It could mean you were city marshal, meaning you were chief of police.
Uh-huh.
But it could also mean that if you were an assistant city marshal, you were basically a patrolman. So it had two different meanings.
How did you become a federal marshal? How did you have to do a federal appointing? Or?
It's appointed by – they were appointed by whoever the U.S. marshals were at the time. And by 1882, Wyatt Earp was a deputy U.S. marshal under Crawley Dake, who was the U.S. marshal to the territory of Arizona.
Well, Earp, before he joined his brothers, as shown in the movie Tombstone, in Arizona, I guess he'd been a lawman in the boom town of, I guess, Dodge.
Dodge
in Kansas.
Wichita and Ellsworth.
Which were big cattle towns.
Right. He later became a police officer in other towns after Tombstone, too.
So, Roger, I've gone to a website and seen one of these Clanton relatives claiming that everybody's gotten it wrong, that it's all about, you know, the right to bear arms, a Second Amendment issue, and that basically the Earps and Doc Holliday gunned down the Clantons and McClurys, two of whom were reportedly unarmed. They almost make it sound like in cold blood. What's your comment to this revisionist version?
Well, it's nonsense. they were armed. The Clantons and the McClurys were armed because that's how Doc Holliday, Virgil, and Morgan got shot. They weren't being shot by somebody else in another building. The Clantons and McClurys and the disagreements between them and the police and some of the townsfolks in Tombstone had been blossoming, or brewing, I should say, for a long time, right back to March of 81. The gunfight at the OK Corral was October 26th of 1881. And for about 24 hours prior to the gunfight, the Clantons and the McGlorys were going up and down the street, threatening the Earps' lives.
Mm-hmm.
There were a number of altercations where they had to be hauled into court. And so then the word came back to City Marshal Virgil Earp that they were down in the vacant alley next to Fly's photography studio, and that they were continuing to threaten the Earps, who were the police officers of the town.
So this isn't that far off from as it was portrayed in the movie Tombstone.
Yeah, and the Citizens Committee, which was a nice name for the vigilantes, wanted to come to the aid of the police because they thought there was going to be a desperate situation. The chief of police, Virgil Earp, says, no, we'll take care of this. We're just going to go down there and disarm them. And that was the intention, to go down and disarm them. It should be noted that in Tombstone, Arizona, it was illegal in the 1880s to walk around with a loaded revolver.
Mm-hmm.
But you can walk around Tombstone today with a loaded revolver. At the time, in the 1880s, Tombstone had fewer murders and deaths by gunshots per population than Chicago had at the time.
Hmm.
It was a relatively peaceful city.
Okay. Who fired first? Do we know?
There are disagreements about that, but it appears that the McGlorys and the Clantons reach for their pistols. And at that point, the Earps pulled out their guns. The Earps typically kept their pistols in their pockets. They did not wear holsters. In fact, the chief of police had his pistol tucked into his belt. At that point, they pulled out their pistols. And at that point, some shots were fired. It could have been one from Doc Holliday. It could have been one from the McGlorys. But at 45 seconds later, there were three people dead and three other people injured.
I gather there was something like 17 rounds fired by each side in 30 seconds.
It was a lot. It was a horrendous noise throughout town. The reason why the gunfight at the OK Corral was so famous was because it was the only time anything like that had ever happened.
Uh-huh.
We think from the movies that this was commonplace
right.
and all the
Western.
It right. wasn't commonplace. This was basically the only time
right.
that Western police officers faced adversaries in a public street, resulting in gunfire.
And fired at each other in point-blank range.
Yeah. These guys were about 15 feet apart.
Yeah.
But most of the fight actually occurred in Fremont Street, which is a very wide street in Tombstone, now a state highway.
Uh-huh.
It was front-page news in the New York Times the next day.
Oh, really?
It was big news throughout the country.
Did not realize that.
Yeah.
In the wake of this, I guess it really gets even more interesting in terms of like Wyatt Earp's impact on what happened, because I guess then it's a matter of vendetta, the two sides still going at it. Compressed in a very short time in the movie, but I guess spread out over many months in real life.
Right. After the gunfight ended, Wyatt Earp and Holliday were arrested for a time. They posted bail. And then there was a hearing to determine whether it was a justifiable police action, and they were exonerated and release, but the Clanton McGlowry crowd and their supporters were not happy with that, obviously, because some of their boys died.
Mm-hmm.
So there was an incident where someone dressed in a woman's costume came to the Earp home and asked for the Earps, and it was obviously a man. And at that point, the Earps concluded, we've got to leave our houses and go into a hotel where we can protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So they went into the Cosmopolitan Hotel on Allen Street and held up there so they could, they circled the wagon, so to speak. The Outlaws, on the other hand, were across the street in the Grand Hotel for the same reason, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very tense environment. So on the evening of December 18th, Chief of Police Virgil Earp was walking down the street, and he was ambushed, and his left arm was practically blown off. And he was incapacitated for months. And then in the following March, Morgan Earp was killed while playing pool at a place, Hatch's Saloon on Allen Street. At that point, Wyatt Earp took over the deputy U.S. Marshal position and shipped his brother Morgan and his brother Virgil, Morgan being dead, back to the Tucson train station so that they could be taken to the family home in Colton, California, in San Bernardino County. And that's when the vendetta period began. The vendetta period is more significant than the gunfight because it's a matter of some controversy as to whether or not Wyatt Earp acted completely under color of law.
And I guess there's an issue of, like, was this even more lawlessness in terms of him going out and just shooting down his adversaries?
He did have a federal budget from a U.S. Marshal. Chester Arthur, the president, was threatening martial law. Nobody seemed to be able to get the rustlers under control. And Earp went out with a party and basically took care of about three or four of these guys. And the first incident was in the Tucson train station, where a guy named Frank Stillwell was waiting for Earp, and they knew he was going to be waiting because they had been notified by either telegraph or telephone the day before. We're never going to be sure what exactly happened, but Frank Stillwell had more buckshot and bullets in him than most people ever could imagine, and the body was just left there. Then they went after Curly Bill Brocious, and I've been to the spot where that fight occurred at Mescal Springs.
Was he another one of the same gang?
He was part of the gang,
uh-huh.
A pretty flamboyant guy.
Well, why'd they take him out? Just out of curiosity.
Well, the Earp party went after every one of these guys,
uh-huh.
And as they were approaching Mescal Springs, these guys started firing on him, and Earp returned fire and got him with a shotgun.
So, Roger, how would you summarize Wyatt Earp's impact on America?
Well, he wasn't an important figure in American history per se, but his impact on popular culture has been substantial. The vendetta period was actively covered by Western American newspapers for the 5 or 6 months of 1882 when Earp's posse was out there. And there was considerable discussion about the need to bring Arizona under control again. And the expression that kept on popping up was, we need to bring law and order to the Arizona Territory. And many of those newspapers were defending Earp and cleaning up the operation. He did clean it up. But he was indicted for murder for killing Stillwell in Tucson, and he fled with Holliday to Colorado. The thing is that this term law and order became a part of politics in the western United States mm-hmm. for decades, and it still exists today. When Teddy Roosevelt became president, he was an admirer of a lot of these Western figures. He was a close friend of Bat Masterson, and he developed the foreign policy notion of speak softly but carry a big stick. It's a hard hypothesis to prove, and it's probably not provable at all. But every once in a while, you will hear people say, America's being too much of a Wyatt Earp, or America is trying to be the Wyatt Earp of the world.
Mm-hmm.
10 years ago when we were in Somalia, a sergeant was interviewed by one of the news networks, and he said, yeah, it's terrible here, but guess what? Wyatt Earp just walked into town. And there was an influence and a connection between the Earp Vendetta period of 1882 and the development of the law and order theme.
Right.
And that America right now is, in a sense, looking at the world as a place where law and order must be returned, or America's going to have to walk down Fremont Street and take care of things.
I guess in a way that is as fresh as today's headlines. And one final thing, Roger, I guess people don't realize there is a local connection here, right here in Sacramento, to the Earp family.
Sure is. Newton Earp, his older half-brother, is buried in East Lawn Cemetery, right close to the entrance, by the way. And he lived in a house on T Street in Sacramento just before he died. The house still stands because I've been by it.
Our guest for this segment has been Roger S. Peterson, a Western historian from Rockland. I said Loomis at the beginning. Actually, it's Rockland, California. Very interesting discussion on Wyatt Earp. I hope you can come and discuss some other aspects of the West and other historical episodes.
Looking forward to it.
All right.
Wyatt Earp, Wyatt Earp, brave, courageous, and bold. Long live his fame, and long live his glory, and long may his story be told.
Thanks again to our guests, Dr. Whitney Lehman, environmental engineer, and historian Roger S. Peterson. We'll see you again next week at 5 o'clock on Thursdays. This is Radio Parallax, and I've been your host, Douglas Everett. Stay tuned in the next 2 hours for Electricity and Lust with Gina. Gina will be helping me, I think, 2 weeks from now when we're going to air some selections among truly bad songs for your listening pleasure. Or displeasure, as the case may be, but I have to say, sometimes when songs are bad enough, they become good.